Hello, and welcome to Disputed. I'm Ted Brook.
And I'm Erin Brand. We are your co-hosts.
Welcome back, everyone. It's been a while since we released our last episode, but that's because it's summer and we have better things to be doing.
Well, in my case, I don't, Ted. I don't know if you actually know this because we're in different offices.
Sorry, I guess.
Yeah, but I have a torn Achilles tendon, so I have not been up to much fun. You know, and this is a legal podcast, not like a health and sporting podcast, but I'll just say if you've been called to the bar for 10 years, stretch before you do physical activity.
Back on track. Okay, so welcome everyone. We have a really interesting episode today. We're talking about a regulatory question, a very peculiar case. Just to give a little bit of background, came across a decision that was released by the Ontario Superior Court last month, and I was puzzled by it. Typically, when I think about the courts interacting with regulators, I'm thinking of judicial reviews, right? A regulator makes a decision, court, you know, someone challenges it, court says yes or no. But this decision that I came across involved a judge of the Superior Court holding an Ontario regulator, a very established regulator, in contempt of court for its decisions on how it should regulate individuals that it perceived to be licensees. I was having a hard time digesting it. I didn't know whether I thought it was the right decision, wrong decision, trying to get the facts right, the law right. And so I reached out to Erin and I said, we need to talk with some regulatory litigators who actually can provide us some insights into the big picture stuff, as well as sort of walking through the details of the case. And that is why we were very lucky to have Chris Muir and David Litwin with us today.
Welcome, guys. It's great to have you.
Hello, hello.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome to the podcast. Okay, so for those of you who don't know her, Chris Muir is a partner in our Toronto office. In addition to being a delightful human, Chris's practice encompasses complex commercial litigation and high-profile administrative matters, including public and appellate law. She represents clients ranging from large corporations and institutions to small business owners and professionals in sectors from health, finance, construction, and education. So great to have you, Chris. We've been wanting to have you on the podcast, so I'm glad this worked out.
I'm so pleased to be here, guys. I'm a little bit nervous. I've never podcasted before, so you'll have to be nice to me.
Well, I think you're going to do swimmingly and find that it's just a fun conversation we're going to have. And so we also decided to do something a little bit different today and invite an external lawyer on to the podcast, which Ted and I are super excited about. So Chris is joined by David Litwin, who is in-house counsel at Ontario's Retirement Homes Regulatory Authority, or the RHRA for short, which regulates about 780 retirement homes in Ontario. David has worked with the RHRA since 2020, managing the legal and enforcement departments, and serves as chief privacy officer. Before that, he practiced civil litigation in Toronto. So welcome, David.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And I'll just add that David is someone who I go to bounce ideas off of and have good chats with when I'm trying to work through issues, complicated issues like the ones raised in this case. But so let's bring the listener in. You are sitting at home. You like turn the volume of the history of regulation of Ontario open to, it's dusty, and you go back years and years, decades and decades, and you find a chapter which says jurisdictional tug of war between two regulators, one being the Ontario Association of Architects and the Association of Architectural Technologists of Ontario. And what you would find is that for many years, these two regulators with sort of overlapping mandates, I don't know if that's accurate to say, have been in disagreements as to who gets to license and regulate individuals in this practice area.
And specifically architectural technologists, I think, which is sort of not your traditional architecture, but sort of a practice that developed with CAD software and a lot of sort of technological advancements, is my basic understanding, to sort of have this additional class of architectural technologists. And that's really, those folks are really at the heart of today's saga.
And that's helpful. I mean, like the decision itself that we're going to be talking about by Justice Akazaki, very first sentence is, what is an architect? Right. And I think another question would be, what is an architectural technologist? Chris, are you able to kind of give us a little insight into this? What is your take on the sort of two main classes of regulated professionals that we're talking about here?
So what I took from it was that there was one regulator on the architecture side. If you want to call yourself an architect, you need years and years of education and expertise and experience and all that good stuff. And then they will issue a license where appropriate to you. And you need an architect when you want to build a big building. So you don't need an architect, which I actually was surprised by, if I just want to add two stories or if I want to build a three story or something like that.
Anything three or less, you don't need to be an architect to design.
Which I was surprised by. But the architectural technologist can help the layperson, i.e. me, with that expansion of their house or whatever it is that they want to do. So you've got a regulator for the architects. You've got that group of licensed professionals. And then you have individuals who can call themselves an architectural technologist who has the requisite experience. It was the Technologist Association who certified those people as being properly calling themselves that. So they didn't regulate them. They were not a regulated profession, but they could certify themselves to the public as somebody who can help you with that three-story expansion or that three-story house or whatever this limitation is.
Even though I could design a three-story house for David, someone with that technologist designation is being held out and sort of certified by the association that this person knows how to use the design tools and has the experience.
And so the Technologist Association was able to say, yes, Ted does have the experience to call himself a technologist. You can trust him to do this, but did not otherwise regulate. Whereas we have the whole regulatory body for the architects in terms of ethical standards, educational standards, similar to lawyers and doctors and all that good stuff. That's how I took the differences.
David, anything that you took we should keep in mind before we sort of dive into the decision?
Well, I think that all I would add is both of the organizations, the Architects Association and the Technologists Association, they're both, I think, intended to advance public interest and public trust. So even with the Technologists Association, like it's been mentioned, one of the purposes is so that members of the public, if they're constructing something, they can have faith that if someone's a member of the Technologists Association, that they've got certain professional skills and qualifications. And the same applies to the Architectures Association. They're a regulator that operates in the public interest. And so that sort of plays into this whole context as it moves forward.
I just want to stop for a second, and just so our listeners know, we're here to talk about today are things like contempt of court, circumventing orders of the court, like really broad principles. So I just want to kind of have that little sort of cue there that we're going to set up all this background of what's happening between these regulated professionals, but then we're going to get into some really broad ranging, I think, comments on the law more generally that isn't really specific to this, that has some broader application. So that being said, background.
So in last month, which is June of 2025, Justice Akizaki fines the Ontario Association of Architects, the OAA, we'll call it, in contempt of court. And so that's what jumped out at me when I saw this. I mean, it's a very peculiar sort of interaction between the judiciary and a regulator. And I think one way to understand how we got to that sort of extreme point is to talk about the OAA's 2010 policy, where it decided that it was going to start issuing licenses to technologists. Like, Chris, is that the way in?
The architects decided that they wanted to take a bit of control over the technologists and maybe take some of that control away from the Technologists Association. And that started a long time ago. And in our decision, Justice Akizaki described that as a turf war between these two associations.
And that policy where they said, look, we're going to start doing this, I guess it sort of evolves and it's refined over the years. And at some point, by about 2022, the Technologists Association says, we're actually going to sue you. We are going to commence a lawsuit, and they do, asking a judge to find that this policy that the OAA has implemented is unlawful.
And I think even before all of this, I seem to recall from the decision that there's also like a trademark dispute between these two organizations. So like there's sort of a long-standing, as you put it, Chris, or potentially as His Honor put it, like turf war between these organizations that sort of comes to a head probably in and around the time of the consent order, I think.
But we're all familiar with the idea of a consent order. I think we've all dealt with them. But Chris, can you just maybe unpack what probably happened, right? We know a lawsuit is commenced 2022, and then May 2023, we get this order, and that becomes pivotal for the contempt decision later. So
very basically, it means that the parties consent, agree to what an order should look like, and then the court issues that order. A judge signs it, and it becomes an order of the Superior Court. It becomes law. And sometimes that happens in the court system, sometimes not. This one did. They used the court system to get an order. And that brought the application of the technologists to an end. Everybody was happy for like a hot second, apparently, with the form of this order.
Yeah. So let me just read from it. May 2023, the Ontario Superior Court issues this order, which presumably has been negotiated and agreed upon by the parties. It says, this court orders that the OAA has no lawful authority to issue licenses based on the OAA's policy of the council with respect to the licensed technologist OAA or similar policy not set out in a regulation under the Act. And that policy being the 2010 policy that they sort of started to start licensing technologists. This is the court saying, here is what we're telling the OAA to do, but it was essentially language that the OAA agreed to.
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, there's a window in time where we get the order and it says these licenses are unlawful, they're void, you're prohibited from doing this anymore, you're done now, Architects Association. And then on January 1st, 2025, they're allowed to do it again because there's been an amendment to the legislation that is now in force, but it's now lawful because the Act expressly provides for the Architects Association to issue licenses, a certain type of license to technologists.
And if that is all that had happened, we would not have an episode to talk about right now. So, David, what happened? So let's go back to that consent order being issued. What happened there?
Yeah, so there's this consent order. And then at some point after it, the Architectural Association sends out some notices to their registrants explaining what's been done and advise that sort of the process that if you apply to become a member and you don't have certain qualifications, it might go to the registration committee. And then the registration committee will have, after it conducts a hearing, may have discretion to impose sort of conditions or restrictions on a license. And then you see some architectural technologists applying for licenses. And initially, the first one, there's, I think, a proposal to refuse the license application. And then ultimately, the registration committee upholds that refusal. And then you get a few more cases where technologists, there start being refusals, and it goes to the registration committee. And the registration committee actually grants a license with certain restrictions on it. And then subsequently, the law changes, and now the Architectural Association can actually license architectural technologists to an extent. And the question becomes, well, what about those cases before the law was changed, when the registration committee started granting certain licenses with restrictions on them? Were those allowed, or were those decisions that were made by the registration committee and the registrar, were those decisions in breach of the consent order that was reached between the parties? And those relatively small number of technologists that were licensed, those kind of become like the centerpiece of this. Were those actions consistent with the court order or not?
Those technologists that applied, like presumably they knew that they were not going to meet the educational requirements for the architecture license. So what's happening there, David? Like, are they reading some tea leaves in those notices that were sent out following the consent order?
Well, I don't know what the individuals thought, but certainly the court, when they looked at those notices, the court considered, well, what's the subtext of these notices? And I think the court was trying to shepherd in non-architects to be regulated. And so when the court later, when it's talking about whether there was contempt, those notices to the sector feature into this sort of broader narrative that the court was trying to land on. Well, what's really happening here? Was there sort of a policy actually in play?
Yeah, I was just going to add that, like, we are kind of reading the tea leaves a little bit. And what we, because at this point in the case, there, the evidence is just clearly contested, right? Two very different versions of things that are happening. But what we do have, I guess, are Akazaki's findings. What stuck out to me, Aaron, was how he says, so the technologists read those notices as a coded invitation to apply, even if you don't have the qualifications, and then appear at a hearing before the registration committee to see if you can get an architect's license with practice restrictions. We won't call it a technologist license. We'll call it an architect's with restrictions. And on that point, Chris, can you speak a little bit to like what practice restrictions are? Like, how does it normally use? Yeah.
It's such an important tool for a regulator. If they are dealing with a regulated individual who is not necessarily meeting the standard of practice, but can, and they will, maybe they need some additional education. So practice restrictions are really common.
For discipline or even at the outset?
Right. So at the outset, thank you for that question. So at the outset and for disciplinary purposes, I was thinking discipline, right? For at the outset, absolutely as well, because you could be somebody who is coming into an educational regime and you got educated in another country, another province. And so you might need to meet a standard here, but you really are qualified to do the job. And so they want to get you into the profession, get you working. But there's some things that you just need to get up to scratch as you start. But they took a different approach here, right? Like what they used was a section of the act that said, here's how you can issue an architecture license if a registrar has refused it. The registration committee can revisit that decision. The person who is at issue can make a whole bunch of submissions about why they should get the license. And here they said, okay, well, you're not an architect, but here's an architect's license with a whole bunch of terms and conditions. And I think that's really what Justice Akazaki took issue with, because he looked at that and said, they're not architects. What are you doing?
Well, I think the important thing is that this differently constituted committee said, no, we can absolutely issue architect's license to technologists, provided that there are practice limitations. And coming back to what you said at the beginning, about three stories or under, I think that this would have allowed them to do four stories or under. So, and then a few other restrictions. So they can't do everything that an architect could do in the province, but they can certainly do the same or slightly more than what was permitted under the 2010 policy. And so maybe that is where the rubber hits the road, because we know that the Technologists Association in 2022, they commenced litigation to get that consent order. And in response to the licensing of these individuals under the architect license with limitations, they commence another claim. And specifically, they ask the Superior Court to hold the OAA in contempt for violating the consent order. So maybe we can just talk a little bit more about civil contempt. I don't know, David, or if you want to talk to that based on your past life in litigation, or Chris, like what does a party have to show to hold someone else in contempt of court civilly?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, because like you said earlier, Ted, it does have quasi-criminal implications, a finding. So number one, a finding has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. So right away, the evidentiary burden is significantly higher than in most civil proceedings, which obviously adjudicated on a balance of probabilities. That's in consideration of the seriousness of the finding. And then in terms of the actual elements that need to be proven, there needs to be a clear and unequivocal order. And that was definitely a live issue in this case, right? Was the order sufficiently clear? because it made reference to similar policies as the sort of more explicit 2010 policy. And so there was a lot of debate around, well, was there a policy being put into place or not? And was there an intentional act breaching the order? You don't need to have a bad faith element to it for this purpose, for the liability part of it, but was there an intentional act? And then with contempt proceedings, it's bifurcated. So first, the court will determine if there has been contempt. And if there has, then the court will typically reconvene sometime later to make a sentencing decision if there's been contempt. And so this case just dealt with the liability question. Was there contempt? Yeah.
Chris, like the starting with that first point, like clear and unequivocal order, what does that really mean?
It's such an interesting issue in this particular case because the regulator, and I think on a very good basis, felt their conduct issuing the licenses in the way that they did after the order was well within their bailiwick because they were not doing it pursuant to a policy. They were doing it pursuant to another statutory provision that they were leveraging, which on the face of the order, arguably not prohibited. That didn't obviously end up going very well for them. But the clarity piece is really around, can you even get somebody in trouble for this? Is it the right thing? Is it the just thing to do to say that somebody is in breach of something? If it's not clear, it's kind of like notice of a proceeding at the beginning. You have to know what it is that you're being accused of doing. And so that's what the order is. It's the, you were supposed to do this. It's really clear. And you didn't do this. And to the extent there's any sort of ambiguity or lack of clarity, it's resolved to the benefit of the alleged contemnor. And that's just fair because the consequences for contempt are serious. You can lose your liberty as an individual. You can go to jail. Everything has to be very clear in terms of space, time, space continuum. And there were real issues around this order. And I think it was because it resulted from a consent process rather than a fully arbitrated or heard process before the court. There's a whole bunch of meaning built in that is never unpacked that allowed some ambiguity.
I think that some of that ambiguity and I think some of the technicalities is one of the most interesting points for me of this case and one of the points of more kind of broad application. And so my question to you, Chris, is where is the line between taking advantage of a technicality or a loophole in an order or a law or a regulation and circumventing that in a way that is prohibited or not allowed? Like, do you have any advice on where you find, because to your point, the OAA might have thought this is a technicality. We're taking advantage of a fair technicality in the law. And the court saw this as, no, you are clearly circumventing. Like, how do you walk that line?
This is like form versus substance. And really, what is the spirit of the order? And the spirit of the order, according to Justice Akazaki, was you do not issue these licenses. Full stop. It wasn't you don't issue them in this way, but it's totally fine to issue it in a different way, which raises the question of why would you enter into the consent order at all? Because actually it doesn't do anything because you get to the same outcome. So he clearly did not like the sidestepping. And I think on the clarity piece, a cautious, a conservative approach when you are concerned as to the scope of an order can be to go back to the court. There's a provision under Rule 60.11 that allows you to go back for directions.
And directions are essentially saying, what did you mean by this?
What did you mean? I didn't get it. I need a little bit of help. Is it tomorrow that Ted has to pay me? Or is it the week after that Ted has to pay me? Like, what is that? And they could have used that here. They obviously didn't feel the need to for lots of, I'm sure, well-based reasons. But Justice Akazaki expresses his dismay with that decision in his reasons, right? They could have, if they thought this was okay, they could have come back to make sure it was okay, and they didn't. And there was something there that really bothered him.
And David, do you think that there's anything there on the timing? Like, this all happened pretty quickly, right? Like, the order is released. It's not like years and years went by before those notices are sent out pretty quickly. It sparks those registration committee decisions and things flow from there. Do you think the decision might have been different if, like, more time had passed, or would that not have mattered?
I think that That's possible. I mean, obviously, in this case, the actual law changed eventually, which actually permitted the licensing of these individuals. Certainly, in this case, if more time had passed, then at some point, the law may not have been consistent with the order. And so that would have been sort of a different issue that the parties would have had to sort out. But yeah, I think that's probably the case that the timing of this, because I think what the court did here is zoomed out a bit and kept its focus on what's the spirit of the order here? What's the big picture of what this whole process looked like, including sort of notices out to the sector and then applications coming in? So I think that the timing probably, the fact that one sort of action cascaded into the next in fairly short order after the consent order was issued by the court, probably factors into this.
I mean, it's certainly... Justice Akazaki refers to the fact that the notices went out immediately, right? So I think I would infer from that 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 was important to him. But I've been struggling with this one. Of all the parts of the decision recently, sort of this, whether the prohibition on the OAA was that clear. I don't know if I'm there. I don't know if I agree with Justice Akazaki. And one of the reasons is that you have to give the alleged contemner the most favorable interpretation of the order. It doesn't mean they're allowed to point to any potential speculative stretch of an interpretation of an order, but I feel like the most favorable interpretation plus beyond a reasonable doubt, I don't know if I'm fully there with Justice Akazaki finding that, well, the spirit of the order was to get you to stop issuing licenses to technologists in, and that what you're doing is essentially that. This was a consent order. It was negotiated. They chose the specific language, right? There was no finding of a court saying that this is prohibited and here are the reasons explaining it. It was all you have is what the parties agreed to in the form of the order. And it just seems like for that to then come back at you is...
Can I poke on that?
Poke away.
What is the point of this order if there is a statutory provision that permits the licensing that was engaged in by the registration committee after the order?
Yeah, like why does it exist?
I think that's right. I mean, I think that this case, the judge was sort of forced to dig into the more like procedural elements of the legislation, because that was the question of, well, was the order breached, sort of hinged on, well, what happened back within the organization when these applications came in? And that in and of itself was, there was a lot of complicated sort of changes of positions between the initial application consideration and then went before the registration committee. And so I think the court like tried to keep its eye on the ball of like, well, this is about licensing and regulating architects. And there was a number of times throughout the decision where Justice Akazaki sort of returns to that, like this, these aren't architects. So no matter what the sort of technical processes look like, and like that they even may be properly employed and they're doing what they're supposed to do to consider different terms and restrictions on licenses, for example, all of that is like, I guess maybe the expression of like missing the forest for the trees kinds of applies in the sense that, well, when you zoom out, we're still talking about is extending the licensing to non-architects, which is what the order is intended to prevent. So that was sort of an interesting piece where the court had to really get into the weeds on like, what are the internal processes here?
Yeah. And I actually don't know if it answers the question of whether or not contempt is appropriate, right? Because the other thing the Technologist Association could have done was they could have sought direction. Hey, these guys are doing this. We see that it's happening. Wait a second. We could use some help from the court on direction under this order. The order has to mean something.
Because in my mind, there are two very different things. One is whether the OAA's and registration committee's interpretation of the act was right or wrong. It could be completely wrong, but that's not contempt of court, right? The other thing is whether this order prohibited them from, in effect, diluting an architect's license through the, I'd say, consistent licensing of individuals with practice restrictions, which is almost a bigger policy decision. And maybe that is in the public interest to make the practice of architecture more accessible for, you know, certain smaller projects.
Like, this is post-COVID when building prices are out of control, housing prices are out of control. Is there a public policy layer here to, like, we need a more efficient, cost-effective ways for Ontarians to build the homes and projects that they want and offer them a bit of a lower cost solution? Like, there is a public policy lens.
Maybe that's not good policy. Maybe it is good policy. I don't know. But I just think it's potentially, to your earlier question, Chris, an answer to what is the difference, right? Why have the consent order in the first place? If you had this other route open to you, it's, well, the consent order said you can't call them technologists according to this policy. Policy's gone. We're going to make a different decision. They're going to be licensed.
But maybe that's not the right question either, right? The question in contempt is this, does the order prescribe something that's clear? And if it does, did you do something contrary? Regardless of how effective, useful, et cetera, that order was. So maybe it's not the right question.
Another really interesting lens and thing to unpack about this case is the change in law, right? Like, but very soon after all of these decisions are happening, they are now legally allowed to do, probably for all these public policy reasons, exactly what they were trying to do. And so is that fact what gets us to the contempt of court, because it's now almost too late for the Architectural Technologists Association to go back to the court? Like, this order is in effect moot.
This quote from Akazaki, I think, really hits that home. He says, or his honor says, having agreed to an order declaring that it operated a licensing program unlawfully for almost two decades, the OAA's position that another year should not really matter now that the government has enabled the objects of the 2010 policy. This argument illustrates the need for a finding of contempt as a final resort. So it's kind of saying it's actually, and because the law has changed, if our court orders are going to mean something, if we allow parties to enter into them or to obtain them on consent, but then at that point, if they're actually going to mean something, we've got to enforce them.
And I think he uses the change in law to underline that what they were doing in the interim was not lawful. It wasn't, and vis-a-vis the order itself, because of the language of the order, which contemplated future regulation, as he read it, at least.
So the decision was released last month. I don't know if it's going to be appealed. Maybe it'll be appealed before this episode comes out. But then there's going to be a sentencing decision, and it'll focus on this period where the OAA was issuing licenses until the legislation changed. Chris, David, are there any sort of bigger picture regulatory lessons that you would take from this, not necessarily applicable to the facts of this case specifically or this specific sector, but any bigger picture lessons?
Well, I think that maybe a couple takeaways include the court did have some interesting things to say about what does policy mean in the regulatory context? Does policy have to be written down? And the court used some like language that I liked, which is that policy can be any underlying idea that guides an institution's conduct. It's a planned and deliberate course of conduct, but it doesn't necessarily have to be written down. It's a good takeaway to remember that policies is there a seed of an idea that's driving action? The other sort of what tied interestingly into that is that there was no policy here, that this was ad hoc decision-making kind of flies in the face of consistency from a public interest standpoint. And so that's a good takeaway too, right? About the importance of consistency in decision-making.
Yeah. Where a regulator might have a practice that they're following. You can't say, no, this isn't a policy. I mean, it could be a policy.
It could be, exactly.
Right? And that sort of came out of the argument that the OAA made that our use of this licensing through the committee was not a policy that was prohibited by the order.
Right. And then I think the other takeaway is, and I think Chris mentioned this earlier too, but you know, when you do have a court order, and if there is lack of clarity, proceed with great caution and err on the side of caution and seek direction, because even good faith and reasonable interpretation of the order isn't necessarily going to save you.
I think that's a really sort of broad-ranging point. Like, at that point, I could easily actually apply in my practice and do on something like sanctions or export controls, where there may be some room for interpretation on the law. I don't know if it would have helped here, but often very good idea is to paper your rationale on something and to sort of put a memo to file on how you interpret this, what your analysis is, especially if it might be something that is a gray area, to make sure that you have. I don't know if that would have been helpful here. Maybe it would have been harmful.
Aaron, that's a great point. I was thinking that the place to paper it would have been in the consent order, right? If your view was that this didn't restrict certain activities, then make sure that the order is clear that it is without prejudice to certain licensing actions that can be taken pursuant to this section. Because if it is negotiated, I feel like we often focus so much during a settlement on the terms of a settlement agreement, and then it's like, oh yeah, just make sure the order works for the dismissal or whatever. But really, that's where you need to be paying attention to the exact thing that is being ordered. Because at the end of the day, a court order, when party comes to enforce it, is like the third rail, as we've sort of seen. Like you judges take this very seriously, right? Even if it is arguably moot now that the legislation has changed.
If you are a public institution, if you are a regulator, if you have a mandate that is animated by the public interest, you really need to be careful when it comes to your compliance with a court order. Because rightly or wrongly, expressly, impliedly, however it's done, the court is going to look really hard at what you've done and whether or not you are upholding your mandate. And I think Justice Akazaki here was really frustrated by a regulator who appeared to be acting in its own interests rather than in the public interest and abiding by what the court had told them not to do.
So sort of bringing all of these threads, you know, together with some concluding thoughts, obviously contempt and the idea of contempt motions and orders in respect of contempt motions is a big theme here. So Chris, David, any, you know, final views on preparing for contempt motions or defending contempt motions?
So, I mean, I think that, you know, when you are either bringing or defending a contempt motion, you know, bear in mind that the judge is going to review the terms of the order rigorously for clarity. And, you know, keep in mind that the order isn't read in a vacuum. It's read and understood in the context of the parties and the underlying issues that are being addressed by the order.
So this idea of like the participation, if you're representing a party in a contempt proceeding, it is different, right? It's different than the civil standard where most of us operate, balance of probabilities, you know, lots of uncontested evidence. And then you get to use that and say, well, the uncontested evidence is this. And you don't have some of that available to you, and nor should you in this context where you have a quasi-criminal proceeding where you have the standard of beyond a reasonable doubt. So if you are defending, you have a whole bunch of stuff to think about as counsel in working with your client. Can you purge the contempt? I mean, is there contempt? Is there not? But if there is, how do you purge it? What can you do to comply with that court order? Do you need to tender evidence from your client? This is a big decision. You don't have to, right? Criminal proceedings, you don't have to call the accused. No adverse inference can be drawn. So if you do tender evidence from your client, what does that look like? And are you opening them up to cross-examination, which might not go well? This is a big decision in a contempt hearing. You really want to be working out the kinks of the defiance or the purported defiance of the court order. You want to show up and you're putting forward a good faith basis for the conduct. There's a lot to think through. If you are bringing the contempt motion, really useful tool, right? But are you doing the right thing? Are you just looking to enforce a court order? That's not what contempt is about. So I think you have to think really hard about whether or not it's the right procedure. Should you be getting direction from the court? Should you be enforcing a settlement? Should you be doing something else? There's other options. It should be a last resort, right? This process. So there's a lot to think about as counsel on the other side.
And on that note, thank you guys so much for being here to chat about this case.
Thanks very much. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, Dad, that discussion was really all for you and your interest in the case. So you have some of your questions answered?
No, I have more questions. No, I do have some of my questions answered. I feel like Chris and David sort of just brought me down to earth a little bit, focusing on the fact that the court, and I think especially Canadian courts, I see this more with Canadian judges than American counterparts from our cross-border stuff, is they're focused on the spirit of the order. What was the point of this agreement that the parties reached? They're not interested in technicalities or gotcha sort of avenues. And I think that came across very clearly in Justice Akazaki's review and treatment and analysis of what the OAA did. So I still am not 100% there. I don't know if this was the right, if I would have decided the same way if I had been on the bench, but I get it now. I think I understand the path that he took, and it's a really peculiar, really unusual scenario. I'm not aware of this ever happening before.
It is a really unusual scenario, but I will say there's a lot of themes here that I think come up frequently. I mean, even going back to the very, very beginning of our discussion where we talked about sort of the idea of technology sort of evolving, creating this new category of architectural technologists, this idea of technology moving faster than the law can keep up with it in terms of regulating that new profession. We have contempt, which is obviously a principle of broader application. We have the idea of like this sort of circumvention, technicality, spirit of the law, a turf war between two different organizations around regulatory issues. So I think despite the fact that this decision in and of itself is quite unique, there are a lot of threads that I think carry over into a lot of across different areas of the law.
Yeah, I'm with you. I totally agree. Well, everyone, I hope you enjoyed the episode, and feel free to check out our other episodes, which are all on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, on our website, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks, everyone.